For FM Radio, this is Chiara Nicoletti from the Berlinale, the 66th edition. Today we're talking about A Quiet Passion, screening in the Berlinale Special Gala, and with director Terence Davis and the actress Jennifer Ely. So how did you prepare to write the script of A Quiet Passion? How did you do research and what were you looking for?
You've got to be able to see. I've got to be able to see the film and hear it. But you've also got to keep in mind what is the story you're trying to tell. You know, because she was a recluse, people think that she didn't have a very full life. She did. I mean, her letters run to three volumes. That's just the letters. But you've got to work out what you want to tell. What is the actual story? And the story is, here's someone who is a genius, wants to write poetry, has got to write poetry, but wants the family never to change, who has these very deep friendships, and when these people go away, she's crushed by it. You know, she has a skin missing, like all great artists. That makes it very hard to live. And I wanted to show that someone was not recognised in her own life, which really does upset me, because she should have been. How do they carry on? How do they carry on? Bruckner is another, you know, one success. In all of the nine symphonies, one success. You think, how did he carry on? Where do they find the courage to carry on? And I find that immensely courageous. And so that's why I wanted to do it.
How did you get on board on the project? Did you know about Emily Dickinson's sister and the relationship they had?
I didn't know anything about Lavinia, about Vinnie, or her relationship with Emily before reading the script. And then I really just read Emily's letters and Emily's poems and Terence's script, because the script is and it is Terence's interpretation of Emily's life. So I didn't feel there was anything to gain by necessarily reading other people's interpretations of Emily's life. So I went to Emily's words that she'd written and Terence's.
I know Terence Davis can be a super meticulous director, and from what I see, you're still friendly with him. So how is that?
Well, because he is meticulous, but he's also right and interesting. So it's only going to why not do what somebody says if they are brilliant.
But also the actors bring their things to it. You can't direct, things just happen. And that's what you've got to let happen. You know, we did most of them in less than four takes, didn't we? Because these actors were just at the peak of, you know, of their powers. It's like listening to a great orchestra, you know. All you have to do is tweak and say, no, could you do that? Could you say that line a little slower? You just literally tweak. And it was a joy. It was a joy to complete. But they're meticulous as well. They do a lot of work on their own, you know, at home and in their Winnebagos or wherever. And one can't forget that either. They do a great deal of work.
And however exacting somebody is, it's inevitably a collaboration, because there are just so many bodies involved and to tell the story.
In the movie, you're also showing the ordinary life of the characters. The fact that, for example, Emily Dickinson had to wake up at 3 a.m. in order to get some peace to write. So how did you research on these particular ordinary aspects of their life?
But my view of it is just as partial. And, of course, that's not her. It's only my interpretation of her. You know, if someone else would come along, we'd find the letters that she wrote to someone called the Master, and we don't know who he was. They may have focused on that. Because it's only my subjective response to it, because of my subjective response to the poetry, and then finding out what her life was like. But I really did feel for her. In fact, my manager said to me, it's the most autobiographical film you've made. And I think he's right. Because, even my bread didn't win second prize. Grrr.
how much, for example, of the most funny and beautiful dialogues between Hamley and her sister Har you took from the letters, and how much of it you came up with?
I wanted them to be have a good times out there. In all families, you know, if they're deep relationships, you have good times as well. And when they're discussing before, ask Reverend Wadsworth to tea, you know, it was the remember that day. I mean, it was so delightful. They kept this wonderful lightness all day to remember. It was a joy, you know, and that brings it alive. And and because it's alive with just love, and they're pleasant with one another, they're enjoying each other's company, and she's being a little bit of a teacher, said, you know, behave yourself, I know what you can be like. And we know that when she says, well, I'll try, you know she won't, but that's what's fun, and that shows a different sort of love, a real caring, because they love each other's company. I think if they'd not been sisters, they'd have been very good friends.
With the character of Miss Buffum, you go for pure comedy. So how much of that was your invention?
When I knew that she had a friend called Miss Vreeling Buffum, I thought, she's got to be fun. I saw a photograph of Miss Buffum when she was about 40, and she looks like a sideboard, as though she's never heard a joke in her entire life. But with a name like that, it's got to be fun. So that's a complete invention. That was me. That was just me. But I wanted her to be fun. But also, she's the one that encourages this strength in her and says, you know, I know you won't compromise, but you've got strength there. She says, you know, you are more have more depth than all of us. And in a way, Emily needs to be told that, but she needs to be told that by a friend. And the friend is, I mean, it was also partially autobiographical, because on Friday nights, my sister's friends used to come around. And I loved Friday nights, and there was always one who was like Miss Buffum. Always from Northern English women are very funny. As I thought, they've got to be like that. She's got to be fun.
I think we all agree that we particularly loved, at least I loved, the part in where you show us the transformation from the young actors to the other actors of them. How did you work on that? Yes, no, I loved it. I loved it because, you know, you're transported to the other actors, in a so fluent way that you don't really not really bothered by the change. So I was wondering, when did you come up with this idea?
When I was writing the text, if you've got to explain that they get older, it's so boring, you know, or going through three or four stages, I thought it's just boring, you know. What would be the simplest way of doing it? And the simplest way of doing it, and I don't know where the idea came from, I thought they'll morph to their older selves. We just track in twice, once when they're young, once, and that's what we'll do. But I don't know where that came from, but I wanted it to be very simple, but I wanted it to be obvious, because then in the next scene you accept that they've got older, whereas sometimes, you know, it can look very contrived. The only other time I've seen someone go from being like a schoolgirl to a young woman is in Letter from an Unknown Woman. You know, you believe that Joan Fontaine is this 15-year-old. You just believe it. And she just transforms into this young woman, and you believe it. But, I mean, that's Max Ophuls, you know, so one can't compete with Max Ophuls. But I thought it has to be something which is direct. They change.
Decision to stay in the house and not to show much of the outside world, was that because of the story or because of financial reasons?
We wouldn't have been able to shoot much outside the house because it's modern, which is why we did two of the exteriors outside in Belgium, because it was a meadow. What was opposite their house was a meadow, so that was constricting, but I wanted the life in the house to be rich, And it doesn't matter whether you go anywhere or not, because you can lead a rich life within your home. But the other was financial. You know, we couldn't have afforded to redress things in America or build things other than the house in Belgium. And it was just, there wasn't enough money.
And when we are outside the house, the scenes with Emily and Miss Buffum and things, that's the actual house. That's Emily Dickinson's actual house in Amherst. So it wasn't like we had a house that we were using just as a location. It was, yeah. And it's now a museum, so it's limited how much you can use it.
Thank you, Terence Davies and Jennifer Healy, for being with us for A Quiet Passion, screening at the Berlinale in the special gala section. And this is Chiara Nicoletti for Fred, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.